This episode will feature depictions of obsessive thoughts, compulsions, and other features of OCD. Specifically, containing detailed stories and characterizations of contamination fears. This episode could be triggering for listeners who struggle with OCD. Please check in with yourself if now's a good time to listen. Or come back later. This episode will contain profanity. Please visit the show notes for specific content warnings and more information. I open the flow of water by grabbing the sink handle with my elbows and pulling up. I pick up the bar of soap and roll it between my hands over and over. I need to see suds, lots of them. I need to get in, around, and through every finger and every thumb. Fuck. I touch the sink.
There could be deadly germs on there. There could be some really, really bad germs on there.
I need to start again.
There could be some really deadly germs
on
there.
How long is it going to take this time? Sometimes I'm here at the sink for what seems like forever. But I can't help starting again if I make a mistake. If my finger grazes the sink or the tap and comes into contact with what I'm told could be deadly germs.
It would probably be safer to just wash your hands again.
If I leave the bathroom with those germs on my finger, I can feel them with me still. My pinky burning, stinging, with all my thoughts focusing on it.
Clean it. Just clean it. Just don't risk it, okay? Just clean it. God, just go wash your hands again. It's not worth the risk.
Here we go again. I don't want to spend my life at the sink. I can often laugh at how silly my OCD can sound.
Oh. See, nothing bad. Nothing that bad is gonna happen from you accidentally touching.
Once I'm able to let the emotional stress pass,
could,
I can see things
more
from
likely
this
doesn't have
logical perspective. Ha. OCD. You're so silly. You sure have a lot of ideas about how germs work and what they mean for the human body.
I sure do. And they're often made up by me.
In these moments away from the stress of getting caught in obsessive-compulsive thought loops, I often ask myself, where did my brain's ideas about germs come from? In a world full of bacteria and disease, what social moments have led to the network of hyperhygienic cultural practices we see in North America today? This is Germ Girl. I'm Chloe Roger, the germ girl in question, here to dive into everything microbiopolitics with you. I'm someone who thinks about germs a lot, sometimes in an anxious way, and other times in a curious way. What do germs really mean to us, conceptually, within the human psyche, and how did it get that way?
Did that person just sneeze?
We need to sanitize the plants.
Both general cleaning and personal hygiene products began to flood into the market.
There's some uncertainty here, and I'm comfortable with that.
Do you ever think of germs?
As the COVID pandemic emerged, I developed, and some of you might relate to this, a strong aversion to germs. And as a result of the overwhelming uncontrollableness of that time, My brain was overrun with anxiety and stress, constantly wondering what potential harming effects my actions, mistakes, choices, and body's ability to successfully ward off harmful pathogens would mean for me and my community.
Really, probably that had germs on it, really like bad. I feel like it had COVID on it, maybe someone coughed on it.
All of that fear and cortisol and guilt and uncertainty had me desperate for any and all kinds of reassurance, no matter how illogical or unscientific. If carrying out an action made the cacophony of thoughts in my head die down for even a little while, I was willing to engage. My ruminations about disease started out by convincing me to take extra caution with regard to my eyes, nose, and mouth. Oh, and my hands, as they would be the vessel the germs would take to reach those vulnerable places. It started with an intense attention towards washing my hands. I was sure to wash them after touching anything with possible outside contaminants. Soon, I became so aware of this notion of being contaminated by outside germs that I was incapable of sitting down on my couch with the clothes I was just wearing outside. Later, I became more or less unable to cook for myself without it taking four times as long as the average person, restarting and rewashing and carefully handling foods and packaging to make sure the food in my hands were sanitary. Living under the cycle of fearful thoughts and anxiously performing reassurance-seeking behaviors are key elements of obsessive-compulsive disorder, a diagnosis I came to identify with as I became more and more overpowered by the need to perform illogical behaviors to soothe my germ fears.
An obsession would be like a series of intrusive thoughts that really get stuck in your brain and put you in a loop and are generally like directed towards a theme. For example, contamination or germs is a really more like widely known obsession, I would say. Compulsions would be like the rituals or behaviors. They can be like mental or physical or like acted out, I guess. Sometimes I call them safety behaviors, like things to quiet the intrusive thoughts and the obsessions, but they're not necessarily actually doing a good job at that. You end up sort of slippery sloping down into like doing compulsions that take up all the time in your day, desperately like craving this feeling of relief that no longer becomes attainable.
This is Tane Wallace. Tane is based in Vancouver, BC, and is a passionate member of the community, oriented towards spreading awareness about mental health within their relationships and through their social media accounts. We sat down to talk about what contamination OCD really means, and the ideas about germs that lie behind the surface of our obsessions and compulsions. So what is this difference between avoiding dirtiness and like avoiding getting sick or just, you know, natural precautions with regards to your health to having contamination OCD? Because I think for a long time I justified a lot of my compulsions by just being smart about it, just not wanting to get sick, you know? So where's that line?
Yeah, I feel like especially during COVID, for example, you were hearing all of these rules and regulations about how to stay healthy, how to protect the people around you, how to protect yourself. So like following mask mandates, washing your hands after you've coughed or sneezed or been on public transit, those sorts of precautions that are not made up in your head, right, that are being told to you, those are typically the norm. Some people do a little bit less, some people do a little bit more. But one of the big sort of diagnostic criteria for OCD is like that it's taking up a lot of time in your day. Obsessions and compulsions are taking up a lot of time in your day. I don't remember the exact amount, but it's like the majority. So if you're doing the most
and you are constantly thinking about being either contaminated yourself or contaminating others or items or what have you. And then your response to those thoughts are that you're going to take actions, whether they're mental or physical, to quiet the thoughts. And you just are spending too much time on it, and it becomes irrational, mm-hmm. which looks different for everyone. Irrational does. But I would say, like, a big way to gauge it is sort of like, does this align with my values and my wants and needs? Like, is this who I am as a person, or am I being sort of puppeteered by OCD right
now? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I think the time is a really good way to concretely define that. Like, I would spend so much time, like, cleaning myself when I got inside from the outside world, like being in the shower for like upwards of an hour and a half. My roommate right now even like teases me for taking long showers, and my showers are 20 minutes. I always like laugh in my head because I'm like, girl, you don't even know what it was like before. I would be scrubbing head to toe two times over, and that's not an exaggeration. Get inside. Lock the door with my elbows. Drop my purse, jacket, shoes, and head straight to the bathroom. Kick the door closed with my foot. Strip everything off, carefully keeping the clothes inside out and shoving them into the hamper. Open up the faucet with my elbows. Wash my hands thoroughly, twice. Turn on the shower. Get inside. Okay. Wash my hands again. Grab the loofah and soap. Scrub my arms, my chest, my back, my legs, my feet. Make sure every part is covered in suds.
I need to see every square inch covered. No germ should be allowed to make it out of this shower intact.
Rinse. Wash my hands again. Wash my face. Keep my mouth closed. Keep my eyes closed. Rinse. Carefully. No water in your mouth, in your eyes, up your nose. Shit. Water got up my nose. The water that was rinsing the germs off my face. Fuck.
Don't worry. You can wash the inside of your nose.
Oh, God.
Just put a little soap up there, just in case. You need to kill the germs that could have gotten up there.
Wash the inside of your nose. Fuck, that burns. Okay, rinse. Ugh, that sucked.
Did you wash your arms yet?
Yeah, didn't I?
What if you forgot? If you can't remember, you probably forgot. Or if you didn't forget, I bet you missed a spot, like some of the germs on there. You better wash them again, just in case.
Wash my arms again. Rinse. Turn the tap off. Grab a fresh towel. Dry off. Go put on fresh inside clothes. God, that took forever. What time is it? Check the clock as you walk past the kitchen. Damn, it's been an hour. My OCD took my body and tried to put a lock on it, like the biggest and most all-encompassing chastity belt. I felt like I needed to do everything in my power to defend the boundaries of my body, to lighten the load of my immune system. No, to take on the role of my immune system. My brain wanted me and my choices to be the first line of defense. So I put locks on my airways, on my hands, on my skin. I locked the ways I chose to socialize, the times I could go outside, and the people I let into my home and how. I developed complex showering rituals that I had to perform any time I re-entered the house. Every time I left the house, I felt I was exposed. Disease finding a way to hitch a ride on my skin or my clothes. Just waiting for the perfect cross-contamination storm it would take for the pathogen to make its way to my eyes, nose, or mouth.
There could be droplets floating in your midst, waiting and praying some vessel like you walk through so the deadly germs could settle on your skin. Did someone cough nearby here that I didn't see? What if we're walking into clouds of disease-filled air?
I learned to find safety from disease through exclusion, carefully vetting what I let pass through my body. Keep the germs out, and you'll be golden. There's a lot of ideas about germs to be learned within this current social landscape. In the 21st century, we have a thorough understanding of microbiology. We know how pathogens are transmitted and contracted between actors, how to clean spaces that may be more likely to harbor disease, and what products and technologies to use to produce cleanliness. Backed by evidence and the scientific method, I know how to kill germs, and therefore how to protect my body. But what did concepts of sanitization look like before we knew what bacteria was? Before we knew how to kill a germ or why we should want to? Catherine Aschenberg recounts in her book, The Dirt on Clean, how cleaning has evolved throughout time and across cultures. Looking specifically at bathing rituals and the soaping that sometimes went along with it, there's much to uncover surrounding the virtue we prescribe to a cleansed body and space in modern-day North America. Early cleaning formulas resembling soap have existed as early as ancient Babylonian, Sumerian, and later Egyptian cultures. Soap's popularity has ebbed and flowed across time and culture, as well as fluctuations in people's preferred usage of the solution, between cleaning clothes, bodies, faces, and hands, or nothing at all. We take the technology for granted now as one of the simplest and most accessible ways to prevent transmissible disease. But before soap and hand washing practices were widely applied, or had the scientific backings to prove their hygienic purposes, humans have nonetheless always had behaviors they performed to intentionally cleanse and purify the body. Cleansing the body for some cultures meant maintaining practices that aimed to keep the body pure, strong, and free from susceptibility to disease. Aschenberg describes the ideological implications of bathing in ancient Greece. Portrayed in Homer's The Odyssey, bathing was considered a transformative, strengthening experience. Submerging and washing oneself in a warm bath would alleviate the grief and misfortune associated with dirtiness. The ancient Romans mirrored the Greeks' captivation with cleansing the body through bathing. Communal heated bathhouses could be found in every direction, and the Romans decked them out. Bathhouses were community gathering places. They had multiple rooms with different features and uses. Both rich and poor classes partook in frequent bathing. Aschenberg describes the Romans as seeing habitual bathing as essential to a person's self-respect and health. Nonetheless, these cleaning rituals did not involve soap. Bathers would cleanse their bodies by rubbing themselves down with oil and sand, and scraping themselves clean with metal instruments called strigils. Well, a lot happened between Greece and Rome,
But to follow the trail of Western ideologies of cleanliness, we should head to medieval Europe next.
So personal bathing and cleaning norms in medieval Europe looked very similar to what we do today, but just a different process, and cleanliness kind of operates on several levels.
This is Devin Patrick. Devin is a medieval studies historian with specific interest in magic, witchcraft, and medicine. Devin and I spoke about what cleaning looked like in the Middle Ages and how societies in medieval Europe conceptualized illness, disease prevention, causes, and remedy.
You would have washed your hands at least 5 times a day. You did wash your hands before every single meal. It was very common. But fully submerged baths are a lot more rare. They're very time-consuming and cumbersome. Not everybody has accessibility to a bath, like a kind of a bathtub. And also filling bathtubs with kind of multiple pots of boiling water takes a lot of time and effort. So you would have kind of cleaned parts. Every single morning, you would have cleaned your face, your teeth, your hands, and your feet. People did keep themselves clean. They would have smelled probably a lot more than us, of course. But there's kind of this very interesting kind of projection onto the past, especially the Middle Ages, that like everyone was just like very, very dirty. Everyone's covered in poo. You see this in a lot of medieval movies, for example, where everything's just filthy. They would have kept their living spaces quite clean. Just like us cleaning our kitchens today, they would have done the very same thing. And medieval people took really great care in their appearance. So whether their clothes were to be kept in really good care or having their hair, beards, everything, nails, hands, all of this type of stuff is really important. You kind of would be looked down upon by your community for just kind of being unkept and dirty. That's going to put you close to being sinful. And so there's kind of this importance within medieval society to be spiritually clean without sin, which was far more important than cleaning behind your ears. Illness is a divine judgment, that God makes all things happen. So too, inflictions, disease, illnesses must ultimately come from God. And it was kind of seen as a way of God purifying souls. So this kind of widespread understanding that disease and physical suffering are meant to kind of purify your soul in the end if you make it through.
And made it through we did, but not without a couple bumps along the way. The many waves of the plague that struck various continents such as Europe, Africa, and Asia in the Middle Ages were one such bumps. Devin and I discussed the Black Death, a particularly devastating outbreak of the disease in medieval Europe in the 14th century, and the adaptations to Western society's conception of disease and medicine that followed.
This was basically an event that caused total societal, economic, political, and cultural collapse. About 40 to 60% of the population in Europe died. That's about 30 to 36 million people between 1347 and 1353. The average lifespan shrinks to about 20 years old in the second half of the 14th century. This would have been horrific. This would have been world-ending, apocalyptic. Whole towns and communities are completely wiped out in a really short period of time. A good kind of like, I guess a good window into the plague and kind of the chaos that ensues is Giovanni Boccaccio's The Decameron. The preface is about the plague breaking out in Florence. And what he tells us is kind of there's these two, there's kind of the religious and the medical, and they are both failing and everybody is just losing hope kind of almost in God, in their relationship with God, and then also with these medical professionals that are scrambling and don't know what to do. And so Boccaccio writes that brothers are abandoning brothers and
mothers are abandoning children, and it's almost like everybody for themselves, like everyone's just kind of abandoning each other because they are trying to survive, and also dead bodies are piling up into streets and whole homes are left empty. There is kind of those two modes of there's the religious and the medical. So the religious, because it's a judgment or punishment of God for the sins of the people, morality was associated with the disease. The church kind of saw this as an opportunity to reform and to try to morally improve things. So kind of going after certain groups of people like sex workers, homosexuals, Jewish people, or people who excessively gambled, etc., and trying to kind of get them to do penance for their sins in a way to try to purify community, thinking that that will please God and then maybe the plague will stop. And then from the medical standpoint or the scientific standpoint, it's miasma, which is causing an imbalance of humors. There was kind of a notion that there was a planetary alignment. It was said that that planetary alignment caused natural disasters like earthquakes and stuff, which then released these noxious fumes into the air, which spread disease through miasma. Kind of by medical professionals, the only recommendation that they gave was to run. Run as far as you can from the city and seek fresh air, which you kind of saw that through COVID in the same way is something that's only really accessible to the wealthy, as they all kind of ran away in their private jets and went and holidayed on private islands, which just leaves the poor to die at high rates, kind of trapped in cramped cities. So who was at risk? People who had a weak complexion or who had really open pores, but also people who drank too much or not enough, people who bathed too much or not enough, people who exercised too much, not enough, and people who had too much sex, but also people who were too emotional. So there goes me. If you're anxious, depressed, or sickly, you're more likely to get the plague. And then, of course, the sinful. The sex workers, the poor, the thieves, are more likely to get the plague. Some remedies would have been to keep the air clean and dry. You don't want to eat and drink too much, or at least nothing humid. You wanted to kind of keep your humors dry, not moist. You wanted to sleep moderately, exercise moderately, and avoid sweating and bathing, but also passions of the mind. So you were supposed to stay in a good mood, everyone. So as your family dies around you, stay positive. There was kind of this notion of avoiding hot baths or the limitation of baths. Hot baths will open your pores, which will make you more susceptible for the miasma to get into your system. However, it's not like they stopped bathing altogether. There is kind of cold baths that you can have. You can still kind of wash.
Submerging in hot, steamy water made the body moist and porous. The skin became far too relaxed and one's pores far too open to face the disease-filled air of plague-stricken towns. It became widely accepted that keeping the pores blocked was one of the only defenses against lethal disease available. Following that logic, Europeans also began adapting their clothing, preferring tightly woven fabrics to keep disease from passing through and causing infection.
Out of this, you get kind of this drastic change in the medical profession. Better training, increased regulations, improvement of physicians now sharing what they've learned about diseases with each other. So kind of writing medical treatises that kind of resemble modern day medical journals and sharing kind of manuals of prevention and treatment.
But what happened when we finally cracked it? When we finally understood that it was those pesky microorganisms that were infecting humans and animals alike, causing all kinds of disease? In order to understand what scientific developments led to this drastic shift, I spoke with two UBC graduate students. Jerry He is a PhD candidate in microbiology and immunology, and Alice Hong, a master's student within the School of Biomedical Engineering. Both work at the Trapini Lab on UBC's Point Grey campus with all kinds of microbes every day.
First, we need to mention this, I think he was Dutch, this Dutch guy who essentially invented the first microscope. And I'm not going to be able to say his name correctly, but I think his name was Anton van Leeuwenhoek. And Leeuwenhoek just had this ultra magnified tube, essentially, and he started pointing at everything he could see, and then he saw a bunch of just like little organisms moving around. And at the time, he called them animalcules.
Wait, so you're telling me they found out ways to actually see germs? To see those scary things wiggling around?
And this was like obviously a world we couldn't see. And so I believe this was also around the 1600s, and so this was, you know, we could knew about microorganisms, at least maybe not everyone believed they did anything, for over 200 years, but people still believed in miasma theory. You'd be walking on like the streets of London, which are probably pretty filthy. They'd, you know, walk by like garbage or, you know, rotting organisms, something like that. It smells really bad, and then they just happen to get sick. So that was the, you know, theory at that time, is bad smells get you sick. And people believe that for a very long time, and there's like a sort of association and truth with that. Like if you come across like something that's rotting away, there's a good chance that there's microbes growing on there.
Between 1795 and 1860, doctors were questioning the link between cleanliness and infection. There was an idea that infection was not caused by miasma, but by materis morbi, or morbid substances that were being transmitted from doctor to patient. And so there began a widespread belief that infection could be prevented by following strict rules of cleanliness in hospitals. So kind of a very prominent figure of this is Florence Nightingale, who advocated for hospital units to be well ventilated, so to kind of prevent miasma from infecting wounds, or the smoke from coal industrial chimneys from poisoning hospital inmates. So 19th century hospitals were more like houses of death rather than houses of healing. Wards filled up with patients with injuries and illnesses resulting from poor working and living conditions, and they were overcrowded and hygienic standards were basically non-existent. If someone died in a bed, they would kind of just pick that person up and put a new patient in there without changing the bed linens. And so this is how infectious diseases, especially post-operative diseases, kind of transmitted from patient to patient. Surgery was kind of allocated to surface things, so limb amputation, removal of, you know, tumors or these types of things. And going kind of into the body cavity was way too risky because you were awake. And so once you get anesthesia, you kind of get this whole new problem where now operations are considered painless. Somebody can be put under, and now you can do more invasive surgeries, and also you can be slower and more meticulous. But what this does is now introduce this huge increase in post-operative infections, or something called hospitalism, which was coined by James Young Simpson, which was kind of a general morbid condition of the building and its atmosphere that produced diseases. And so you get things like gangrene and sepsis just kind of running rampant.
And then it was really around, I think, the late 19th century, so the late 1800s, that this guy and his name you might have heard of before, his name is Louis Pasteur, and he invented the pasteurization process. But at that time, he essentially conducted a set of experiments called the swan neck experiments to show that bacteria are the reason that at least food spoils.
So Louis Pasteur was a French chemist, and he was kind of approached by a winemaker in France to study why the wine was going off. And so he began to study fermentation and putrefaction in wine and meat, and discovered that this fermentation and putrefaction was caused by an introduction of microorganisms from outside, especially from the atmosphere, which resulted in the spoiling of various foods.
Not too long after that, there's another very famous microbiologist. His name is Robert Koch, and he was the first one to really show. So Pasteur showed that microbes cause food spoilage, but then Koch showed that for certain diseases, bacteria are the direct causes of them. And so he showed this for tuberculosis. So Mycobacterium tuberculosis is directly responsible for tuberculosis. He showed it for cholera. So the bacterium Vibrio cholera is responsible for cholera. And he also showed it for, I believe, anthrax as well, and maybe a couple others.
So this is the beginning of microbiology, and this becomes essential to the development of Joseph Lister's antiseptic methods. Joseph Lister, who witnessed the first surgery under ether as a young medical student, basically became really preoccupied by trying to figure out this hospitalism, like why these people are just dying at high rates of post-operative infections. Pasteur's ideas led Lister to the notion that this airborne bacteria was entering the wounds and causing high rates of post-operative infection and death. And so interestingly, Lister merges Pasteur's new germ theory with this kind of classical notion of miasma, believing that the bacteria is airborne and that it enters the wound, causing the fermentation to begin and infection to set in. However, by about 1881, Lister abandons this complex system and endorses the German bacteriologist Robert Knott's work on how particular species of bacteria are entering the wounds through physical contact. Kind of the merging of Pasteur and Lister is around the fact that Lister actually uses Pasteur's germ theory that was more looking at food and applies it to human beings, realizing that the same microorganisms that cause food to spoil are also causing these infections in people.
It was like an uphill battle. So even after Pasteur and Koch, there were a lot of, like, the medical community, for example, didn't want to believe germ theory, because the doctors, which were essentially all men back then, thought they were gentlemen, and they're like, very notion that our hands can cause disease is an insult to my gentlemanness. Back then as well, they didn't sterilize any surgical tools or anything. And it was like an uphill battle, and probably took like 50, 60, 70 years before finally people started to adopt germ theory and started sterilizing surgical tools.
Joseph Lister begins to develop an antiseptic and lands on Coburg acid, which at that time was used in the processing of sewage. He kind of watered it down because full-blown Coburg acid would do more harm than good.
Finally, they're getting the right idea. I like this Coburg acid.
Lister's antiseptic did not provoke a revolution in any way. Lister would kind of face relentless ridicule for his antiseptic methods from his contemporaries. Basically, not all physicians or surgeons were on board with Pasteur's germ theory, so Lister's use of that caused them to kind of discredit him. They did believe that, or accept that, bacteria caused infection. They just weren't, like, on board with Pasteur's, like, germ theory per se. Basically, Lister just figures out that it becomes too difficult for these old surgeons to unlearn their deep-rooted methods and beliefs. And just instead of trying to convince them, he finds it easier to convert young students to his theories and methods. By the 1870s, a lot of Joseph Lister's methods begin to spread and be adopted in hospitals in France, Germany, and America.
At the time, it was definitely really important, especially for the medical community, to just learn about what germs are, how we can prevent spreading them when you're treating patients, especially people with open wounds. And just avoid a lot of deaths that were being caused by people not knowing about how to have like sterile or aseptic techniques.
As we have come to know them more and more, germs have come to symbolize really scary things for humans. They pose as threats to our well-being and can creep into our bodies without consent and cause plenty of different kinds of disease. Sadly, no matter how concerning it may be, it is completely futile to try to exile these microorganisms from ourselves and our spaces. We have come to understand germs as others, things that invade us and infiltrate our bodies, producing disease and death. But Ironstone writes that microbes are more than just part of the human body. In their trillions, bacteria, fungi, and more live symbiotically on and within our bodies and produce vital bodily processes. Through new scientific tools, humankind has been able to study the body at smaller and smaller increments, according to Ironstone, which has directly affected the way we understand life in relation to germs. The discipline of microbiology and the envelopment of the human and the bacterial directly challenges social ideas of the body as having any capacity for any kind of immunity against outside germs. Our bodies have and will always be porous, influenceable, and in some of its capacities, controlled by germs, by microorganisms. There's no way one could accurately draw a line between us, the human, and them, the germ. We co-create one another.
It has sort of arguably gone almost too much the other way in terms of over-hygiene, over-sterilization. And now, like, there's a lot of emerging research that if you are, and there's this whole thing called the hygiene hypothesis, which is essentially what I'm talking about. How, you know, maybe washing your hands too often or just not letting yourself interact with the environment as much and being overly clean is detrimental to humans. And if you think about it, like, I have no idea how long humans have been around, but we spent a lot of time evolving back when we were a microbe. We spent all the millennia evolving with microbes. And so it is like a shock to the human body, a human organism, to sort of just remove microbes from the environment around you. And yeah, there's emerging research now that, you know, the more overly hygienic you are, there's like you're sort of more at risk, or there's a higher association with various allergies and also autoimmune disorders. And a lot of this has direct ties to your body not being able to interact with microbes in the environment around you.
Yeah, that's very interesting for sure. I think there's a lot of consequences to like trying to completely exile germs from our systems. So to kind of lead into that, I want to talk about the human microbiome. And can you guys define that in like simple terms? Like, what is the human microbiome?
The part of the human microbiome that's like the most talked about these days, especially because it has so many implications to our overall health as well, is our gut microbiome, which is like specifically what we study as well. And that includes basically all the microbes from bacteria to phages, which are viruses that infect bacterial cells that exist in our gut or like along our intestinal tract. But it's not just that. We also have a like skin microbiome. There is like a vaginal microbiome as well, which is really important. We're like a whole ecosystem of different microbiomes and cells that we kind of like live in symbiosis with.
Yeah. Like, what's the ratio between like how many cells in the human body are human and how many cells are like non-human?
Yeah, so as you can sort of imagine, there's a very wide range of estimates. I'd say the general sort of consensus is that there are around the same amount of non-human cells in and on the body as there are human cells. And actually, a lot of people would say that there are more microbes than host human cells. And, you know, it could be like actually a few fold more, a few 10, 100 times more.
I think it's a really hard thing to estimate.
Yeah.
And the numbers that you'll find online are constantly being updated.
Yeah, I found that, like, when I was doing my research, I was like, okay, is it 1-to-1? Is it 10-to-1? So, yeah, very interesting.
Which is smaller, like microbes? Or
microbes are much smaller,
right?
Yeah.
So
you could think of one, like, human cell. If you were to, I guess, think about, like, surface area, it could probably fit. It depends on the microbe, obviously, as well. And, like, things like fungi are bigger. But in terms of bacteria, you could probably fit like over around maybe 1,000 bacteria per one host cell. And for viruses, it's even more. Viruses are much smaller than bacteria.
Very interesting way to conceptualize that.
And I think it's like quite a peculiar and like new concept for humans, just like as a species, to know that there's things that we can't see, but that we presume is kind of everywhere. And I do think like maybe now it's a fine balance of thinking, it's okay, there are germs everywhere, it's not gonna always harm you necessarily. But I think it is, for many, and myself especially during COVID, like kind of a weird concept to know that, like, yes, microbes, maybe viruses, are kind of everywhere around us, and it can be bad, but it's not necessarily always a bad thing. I don't have to wash my hands just because I touched the surface. Yeah, I remember COVID was quite a weird time where, like, personally for me too, I was just hyper, like, aware and just thinking about it constantly, which to me, like, doesn't seem too natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I totally agree. I think it's really interesting to me, like, how our, like, window into this, like, micro world changes the way we conceptualize disease and, like, conceptualize society and community. And conceptualize touching things. Yeah, it's super crazy. So I think it's a lot for the human brain to handle. That discovery was definitely very influential. So I'm definitely like very interested in the philosophy of whether germs are really like foreign to people or if they're an intrinsic part of the human experience. Doesn't that mean that they're also like an intrinsic part of us? And, like, in my experience, I previously tried to, like, exile germs from my body, trying to keep myself feeling protected from disease and, like, discomfort and mostly just from anxiety and my OCD. Like, that's how it would play out. But I've been on a journey of learning that it's pretty futile to try and do this. What do you guys feel like you can share about what you think about the relationship people have to germs?
Yeah, I think they are definitely a part of us and has always been. We just haven't necessarily known about them. Just as like hundreds of years ago, we didn't know that we were even made up of cells. These are just a different kind of cell. I think it can be quite scary, especially when the focus has been to try to identify why we're getting sick. Like the whole germ theory was to understand and prevent disease. To kind of like wrap our head around the fact that most germs or most microbes aren't bad for us. They could be good. They could be just neutral. We have just luckily been able to identify the ones that are bad and learn how to kind of treat them, avoid them, make antibiotics, for example.
Yeah, I mean, call us biased, I guess, because it's what we study. But I would also definitely consider them like intrinsically as a part of us. We evolved with microbes, and you know, trying to like rid yourself of microbes is sort of futile in that it's like really hard, probably impossible.
Because you guys work with microbes and like understand these concepts so well, like what kind of advice would you have for people who want to maybe have a more accepting lens when thinking about germs?
I mean, I think we're a bit too deep because, for example, sometimes Alice sings to her bacteria for her experiments to work. But I think at least what has sort of helped me the most, not just in terms of the whole like hygiene thing, but also just like in the lab, is to think of, you know, these microbes as your friends. Because especially with COVID and this whole like onset again with like over hygiene and being too hygienic, like I was born in 1999, so there was like 20 years before that where I just lived in complete peace with the bacteria. And I know that's not the case for everyone, but you know, they are your friends. They don't, like, at least the microbes, like your microbiome, for example, they don't hurt you, and they're fighting for you to you know, prevent actual bad microbes from infecting. You know, they're doing that for you, but you're also helping them. Like, you're giving them a place to live and be happy.
Like I said before, like, we are an ecosystem. We're not just made up of human cells. They've always been a part of us. And like Jerry said, oftentimes they're helping fight against the bad germs as well. And I think of it more as like lucky that we were able to find out about these bad germs, bad bacteria or viruses, so that we can learn how to combat them and not have them be such a big problem to our health. But those are just a few out of the millions, probably more, of either like beneficial or like neutral microbes. And yeah, it's like good to know about them, learn about them, learn how to treat them, but a few bad bugs doesn't define like a whole like world of microorganisms. And also, if you've ever just like looked up an image or like a video, like a microscopy video, a lot of times I think they look quite cute. Yeah,
that's amazing. Okay, we have to look at them and notice their cuteness. Yeah. And they remember that they're our friends. Yeah, they wiggle. My OCD really didn't care to consider how cute a microbe might be. The fear of contamination made me feel as though touching something as mundane as a door handle or a light switch left my hands as dirty as if they were covered in mud, as grimy as if coated in thick tar, poisoned as if I had just dunked them in toxic waste. The sense of corruption was so strong, as was the need to clean, remove the possible contaminants. My hands crying out incessantly, my fingers squirming until they were finally met with the release of soap and water. But this cycle was endless. Moving through my day, I was constantly running into conceivably contaminated things. It all felt so threatening and unavoidable.
This was something that I thought about a lot. Contamination, the concept, what is it, right? Like, is everything contaminated?
Yes. Yes, it is, Tane.
Yeah,
that's
no.
That's correct.
That's sort of the conclusion I got to, was like...
Yeah, right? Like, everything is contaminated because that's the natural world. That's what life is about. Things intermingling and creating other things is how you and I became to be. So
gross.
Yuck. Like, in our essence, we are contaminated. We're not just one thing. We have a billion things going on. We have a whole microbiome going on.
You ever heard of skin mites?
Skin mites are happening. We have mites in our eyelashes happening as we speak in the studio right now.
We're covered in mites.
Okay, yes, it's true. Like, to accept this fact that there are germs all over us is very daunting, but also for me that was very freeing, because it made me finally realize that my resistance to, honestly, trying to act as my own immune system was futile, if that makes any sense. Yeah, I learned through trying to reduce my compulsions that things actually ended up looking pretty okay if I didn't, like, exile all these microbial germs from my body and my spaces. And also that my whole, like, determination to eliminate these outside germs was of no consequence, because human life is full of outside germs. We're made up of microbes. We eat them. we share them between one another. They're in our gut, and who's to say where we draw the line between what is us and what is them? I don't know if you knew this, but there are trillions of microbes living on, in, and around our bodies. You got a trillion, I have a trillion.
Together, we got 2 trillion?
Yeah. I was about to say 6 trillion.
I don't think...
Because I got caught up on the 3 of it all.
No, your math is right. Mine's not.
Is it?
I am confused.
1 trillion.
I feel like we could cut this part out.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. We sure can. So what do we gain by defining germ as the enemy? And does that actually lead to the best outcome? I think no.
I'm leaning towards no as well. Like, just like thoughts, like germs are neutral. Just like pretty much everything. Things are neutral, right? There is no the good and the bad. Morality doesn't apply to objects.
Yeah.
In that way, right? Like, so, like, if germs are just things, how can they be good or bad or evil or the enemy, right? Like, it just, like, logically doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, we frame germs as something that are bad for us because they can cause disease and they can cause death. But many things can cause disease and death. Other humans could cause disease and death. So to qualify specific germs as bad, it can make sense when you're thinking about things from like a medical perspective. But conceptually, again, like you said, they're completely neutral. It's just an organism trying to survive. And for them, surviving could lead to death for humans. And that's really hard to grapple with. That's what causes these big uproars of fear and anxiety that lead to the OCD cycle continuing.
Yeah. One sort of mentality that a lot of like OCD practitioners talk about is doing things scared.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're feeling scared and you don't take that as a sign that like you're about to die, or maybe you do, but you still do the thing. And I'm not saying be totally reckless, but we are doing it scared as hell, and it feels incredibly rewarding to be able to say, like, yeah, I was anxious, I was scared, I still did it, and it's done, and I feel fucking great.
Yeah, it's important to remember that feelings subside. You're going to feel anxiety come up, whether you like it or not, in different situations, and it's important to just keep going. If you feel anxious, keep going.
Lean into it.
Lean in. I remember a time when I was visiting one of the Gulf Islands, and it was one of the super, super small ones where there's no large ferry that takes you there. Like, you can't drive onto the ferry to go there. It's a water taxi. So it's a small boat that can seat 8 people that you reserve. It drives you 20 minutes from, like, Vancouver to this island. You get off, you enjoy the island, you have to bring all your groceries and all your necessities. And then, yeah, there are certain points of the day where the boats stop working, the boat drivers go home, and you really just cannot leave the island, even if you wanted to. So I remember there was one time where I had gone over there to visit my friends. They were having a really nice night, and I got this really intense, intrusive thought that I was going to contract a disease from someone because they were exhibiting symptoms. My whole body was saying, like, get out of here, like, get out of here, leave, you need to go home. you need to make up an excuse and go home. But I literally couldn't go home. I could not leave. I couldn't leave the island. Big time exposure therapy moment. So instead of, I don't know, maybe locking myself in a small room away from everybody and riding out the night with some sort of comforts that I would try to acquire, I just stayed with everybody and we jumped in the ocean. And I remember like running off the dock and jumping in the ocean, and I had just the biggest anxiety living inside of me that I couldn't find relief from. And jumping in the ocean was really nice. It made me feel really happy, and the anxiety was still there, and then we kept jumping in and coming back and jumping in and coming back. And after a while, I didn't feel the big emotion anymore. And then it would come up again, and then it would go away again, and it would come up again, and it would go away again. But being able to, against my own will, avoid leaving, avoid avoidance, was really beneficial for me in the long run.
The isolation that OCD wants you to experience and the community and love that saying no to your OCD like can give you, they're such polar opposites. And it's so important to have those experiences where you see, like, I can enjoy things. Even if I'm feeling anxious, even if I'm scared, I can have a new experience that sometimes it's not going to go well because you're going to just remember feeling like poo the whole time. And sometimes it's going to be a beautiful memory that you can look back on forever, right?
I had to take control of my OCD. A combination of therapy, medication, and doing things scared helped me finally get back into the driver's seat, make choices for myself, and not let OCD dictate the direction of my life. Remembering the experience I had on that beautiful remote island, I'm reminded that I often struggled with the intrusive thought to leave social situations early when triggers popped up.
You heard that sniffle, right? That can't be good. Just leave. Just make up an excuse. Anything.
No, I don't want to leave. I'm not going to listen to you.
That's a really bad idea. You're going to get COVID if you stay. In a couple days, you'll get symptoms. You'll have to call in sick for work. You'll feel really horrible. You would pass it on to the rest of your family next.
No. I'm okay. I don't have to listen to you.
Okay, at least wash your hands. Just go wash them a couple times. Be really careful with what you touch after that. And if you touch something you think they may have touched, you just go wash your hands again, okay?
No, I don't need to wash my hands. I'm comfortable living with germs.
What? No, that's not safe. You could die from germs.
I'm comfortable living with germs. I don't need to do anything.
No, you can't be serious. What if?
I'm comfortable living with germs. I don't need to do anything.
I feel like you need to do something, don't you?
I'm comfortable living with germs. I don't need to do anything.
I'm
comfortable living with germs. I don't need to do anything.
I don't know. No, I really do. Please do something.
I'm comfortable living with germs. I don't need to do anything.
I'm comfortable living with germs.
I'm comfortable living with germs.
I'm comfortable living with
I
germs.
Don't need to do anything. I'm comfortable living with germs.
Comfortable
I don't need to do anything.
With germs. I guess I don't need to do anything.
I'm comfortable living with germs. I don't need to do anything.
I don't need to do anything?
I'm comfortable living with germs.
I don't need to do anything.
I'm comfortable living with germs. I don't need to do anything. If you're struggling with health-related anxiety, germ fears, or have any symptoms of obsessive-compulsive disorder, there is help out there. Within your community of support and through healthcare practitioners and mental health resources. Although OCD specifically can leave you feeling hopeless, isolated, and so extremely stuck, I'm so grateful to be able to tell you you will make it through to the other side and find ways to regain control over your life and your choices. To explore places to start, visit the show notes, complete with specific mental health resources. This project would not be possible without the support of Kira, Francis, and all the other members of the Power and Voice cohort at CITR. I'm endlessly grateful to those who I interviewed, Tane Wallace, Devin Patrick, Jerry Hee, and Alice Hong. A huge thank you to Misha Air Murphy and Chuba Laszlo for music production. Finally, extending my thanks to my community, friends, and family who've supported me throughout this project and have helped me get to where I am today.
This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Thank you to the program facilitators Duncan McHugh, Hina Imam, Stephanie Quetasil-Wetwood, Helena Crobath, Christine McKenzie, and Alex DeBoer, who all acted as guides, inspiration, and educators for this project.